You can shop from anywhere doing pretty much anything. You might shop while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast. And however you shop, we all know and love the thrill of the hunt. But do you also know how to get the thrill of the best deals? Because Rakuten shoppers do. With Rakuten, they get the deals they love with the most savings and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Sephora, Nike, and even Expedia if you're looking to get some travel in. And getting cash back doesn't mean you have to miss out on sales because those can just be stacked right on top. It's easy to use and based on a simple idea. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers, and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back through PayPal or check. Download the free Rakuten app and never miss a deal. Or go to Rakuten.com to start getting the most bang for your buck. That's Rakuten.
Have you ever watched an apocalyptic sci-fi movie and wondered, could any of this really happen? I'm Carrie Bechet, and on Hypothetical, we explore what-if questions two ways, through speculative science fiction and through insight from the world's most brilliant scientists. And spoiler alert, your favorite sci-fi movies aren't nearly as far-fetched as you may think. Time travel with me into our possible futures on Hypothetical. New episodes every Tuesday, available on all podcast apps. That's Hypothetical, Hyperthetical.
Hi, I'm Madigan, and you're listening to Your Angry Neighborhood Feminist, a podcast that explores the world through a personal feminist perspective. Hello, everyone. Good day, sunshine. It is lovely here in Los Angeles. I know that probably sounds redundant to people who don't live here, but you know, it's been a little bit doom and gloomy here lately, and it feels really nice to have the sun shining and the birds chirping. It's taking away my seasonal depression and bringing in just my regular old depression. It's beautiful. This week has been a little bit different for me because I've been house slash dog sitting for the family that I also do some nannying for. And because I've been away from home, I haven't been able to do as much work on the computer and such and do as much recording. So I've just got one topic for today's mini episode that I wanted to get into. But at the very end of the episode, I'm also going to share a little bit of the bonus episode that I put up on Patreon in the Mad Gabin with Madigan tier, where I covered Rachel Corrie, who is another American activist who went to Gaza back in 2003, I believe, if I'm remembering correctly. And she unfortunately lost her life there while she was trying to defend the homes of the Palestinian people in Rafah. And she has a really fantastic story. It's a very tragic story, but it's also a very important story as well because it shows the disparity in the highlighting between the white activists that go to other countries to defend them and the kind of honor and respect that they get compared to the Palestinian people who are defending their own homes and their own land. So definitely stay tuned until the end of the episode to get a little taste of that. And if you want to hear the rest of the episode, you can join the Patreon at patreon.com/angryneighborhoodfeminist or click the link in the show notes. I'm going to start adding more and more little bonus episodes here and there to Mad Gabin with Madigan. My goal is to get 2 up per month right now. I actually just agreed to do another project, but I'm very excited because this is another solo project of mine that I will be hosting. And I'm not going to talk about it yet. Once I have everything kind of signed on the dotted line and everything is agreed upon, I will let you all know what kind of shenanigans I'm getting into. So definitely look forward to that. All right, enough of me yammering on. Let's get into some more tragedy, shall we? On Wednesday, March 26th at about 1:30 p.m., the main spans of the Francis Scott Key Bridge across the Patapsco River between Baltimore and Dundalk, Maryland, collapsed after a container ship struck one of its support pillars. I'm sure you've seen videos on social media or you've seen it on the news. It is absolutely devastating to look at. It is so, it's like from a movie and just, oh, it's so scary. The Francis Scott Key Bridge has been a major shipping port giving access to the Port of Baltimore since it was built in 1977 and is one of the busiest in the United States. This port in 2023 handled more than 444,000 passengers and 52.3 million tons of foreign cargo valued at about $80 billion. The bridge is 1.6 miles long and has four lanes of Interstate 695 highway, a beltway around Baltimore, which is used by roughly 34,000 vehicles every single day. There had been one previous collision with this bridge back in 1980, but the bridge was relatively undamaged from that collision. The container ship that hit the Key Bridge this week was registered in Singapore. It's called the MV Dali, and it was operated by Synergy Marine Group. Built in 2015, the ship was 980 feet long, with a width of 157 feet and 40 feet in depth. The 22 members aboard the Dali were employed by a Danish company, Maersk. I think I'm saying that right. Sorry for the mispronunciation if so. And it consisted of mostly Indian nationals. They traveled from Panama to New York, getting there on March 19th, 2024, then went to Portsmouth, Virginia, before departing from Baltimore on March 22nd, getting there the following day. The Dali left the Port of Baltimore at 12:44 a.m. Eastern Time on March 26th, 2024, heading towards Sri Lanka. It carried 3,000 containers on its ship. About 40 minutes into their voyage, the ship suffered a total blackout and began to drift out of the shipping channel. They tried to use their backup generator, but it didn't power the propeller system. As part of the emergency procedure, the ship dropped their anchors and a mayday call was made from the ship. They notified the Maryland Department of Transportation that control of the vessel had been lost and that a collision with the bridge was possible. Immediately, further traffic was stopped from crossing the bridge. The police allegedly only had 90 seconds to accomplish this. But there were also eight construction workers on the bridge fixing potholes at this time as well. Back on the ship, the lights flickered on and off a few times, the power coming back on just before impact. Then, the Dali struck the support column of the bridge at a speed of approximately 8 or 9 miles an hour. Within seconds, the bridge broke apart in several places, leaving pieces of the bridge protruding up out of the water and the roadways on either side still standing. The main span of the bridge fell right on top of the ship's bow. The whole thing took a total of just 30 seconds. Emergency teams were called and a large-scale search and rescue mission went underway. The U.S. Coast Guard deployed boats and helicopters, public safety divers were asked to search for people who fell into the river, and a total of 50 divers divided into 8 teams went into rescue efforts. After the collision, several shipping containers fell into the water, and there was hull damage above the waterline as well as damage from the bridge impaling its structure, but the ship still remained watertight. The ship's crew, including the two pilots, were accounted for and, amazingly, did not sustain any injuries, apart from one who was hospitalized for a minor injury. But 6 people, all part of the construction crew working on the bridge, were all reported missing. The National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, announced that they began an investigation, as did the FBI. Singapore's Transport Safety Investigation Bureau and Maritime Port Authority will also travel to Baltimore and have their own investigations and offer their support. Immediately after the disaster, the United States Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg, said that he was in contact with the Maryland Governor, Wes Moore, and Baltimore's Mayor, Brendan Scott, to offer the department's support. Moore declared a state of emergency shortly after that, and a suspension began on all shipping to and from Port Baltimore until further notice. And I'm not going to get into this, but I will mention it. This is obviously a huge blow to, I don't know, our economy. We're not going to be getting as many imports and exports. And you know what? I'm more focused on the human lives, so let's keep going. Investigators have been collecting evidence since the collapse, and divers continued to search through the twisted metal to try to find the 6 construction workers who had fallen into the harbor, though they have all now been presumed to be deceased. By Wednesday night, Coast Guard Rear Admiral Shannon N. Gilreath said, quote, "We do not believe that we are going to find any of these individuals still alive." They also decided to pause their search for the remaining construction workers still in the harbor. which is a really hard pill for me to swallow. And I don't know if I'm going to get into this rant now or later, so maybe I'll just get into it now. But I can't help but wonder if the search and rescue efforts would have been more vast and more detailed if these were white American-born people that were fixing these potholes on that day. It was not. It was all migrant workers. And because of that, obviously, our country sees them as lesser than. And I'm going to get into that more later on in the episode. But I can't help but see a glaring disparity in how quickly the search efforts for their bodies were called off. And I guess you could have the argument that they're not alive. It would just be bringing their bodies back. But I don't think that that should be up to law enforcement or authority. I do think that the level of danger has something to do with it. There, unfortunately, are many bodies of loved ones that are never found, but you never know what a person wanted with their remains after they passed. You don't know what the family would have wanted. You don't know what their religious beliefs are, what their cultural background is. And I feel like the most respectful thing to do for any human being is to use as many resources as you possibly can to do your best to find your fellow human being and bring their bodies home to their loved ones so that they can be mourned and so that the loved ones can grieve and move on and show that you actually care about the person who lost their life.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch, and organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business, from the launch your online shop stage all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Do you like science fiction? I'm Carrie Bechet, and if you loved movies like Arrival or Interstellar, then you're going to want to check out my podcast, Hypothetical. On Hypothetical, we tell speculative sci-fi stories interwoven with real science. New episodes every Tuesday, available wherever you get podcasts.
Okay. Governor Moore did express his heartbreak after officials decided to suspend the search for the bodies, and the loved ones of those missing have been waiting for hours at a Royal Farms convenience store near the entrance of the bridge for word, and they were devastated by the news. I don't blame them. On Thursday, Governor Moore reassured the loved ones of the construction workers that they are not ending the search for them, but that they hope to continue to investigate their whereabouts. I don't know. It doesn't seem promising that it's paused right now. I don't think that a search for missing people should have a pause so soon. I think that you should have kept going. I don't know. I don't know what I'm talking about. Since the tragic events, people have been wondering how this could have happened. How were the people on board the ship not better equipped to handle such an emergency? Or was there something wrong with the bridge? Well, it turns out that there has been a massive increase in shipping vessel size since the first collision with the Key Bridge in the 1970s and the one that happened this week.
Hi, everyone. Sorry for the subpar sound quality here. I'm having to use my AirPods because I'm editing this episode back at the house that I am house/dog-sitting for. But I just realized that I said 1970s when the initial collision was actually in the 1980s. Sorry about that.
Public records showed that hundreds of bridges over the U.S. waterways were built decades ago when container ships were a fraction of the size and weight that they are today. For example, the Dali had a capacity of about 10,000 20-foot equivalent units of cargo, while in the 1970s, the cap was at 2,500 20-foot equivalent units. I'm going to post a diagram to the Instagram page if you're interested, and you can take a look at the difference in size. So clearly, there were some structural things. I don't know if it's negligence. I don't know if it's pushing boundaries. I don't know what it is, but it looks like there will be some sort of investigation that is going to take a very long time. I read in one article that they are saying that this could take about 2 years to fully investigate. I'm sure there will be more and more answers coming out over the next few days and weeks, and I don't know, maybe even years. But the biggest takeaway for me from this story is the apparent lack of care for the migrant workers who lost their lives on Tuesday. An article from the Washington Post reads, quote, "Does America need a more searing visual image than eight men working for their piece of the American dream, filling potholes on a terrifying bridge at 1 a.m. in darkness, to understand that our nation was built by immigrants, runs on immigrant labor, and needs immigrants?" Being that it's an election year, immigration is a major talking point at the moment, especially for the presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump. Like I said in last week's mini episode, more than half of the United States, apparently from some studies, show that Americans see immigration as a very serious problem. But again, like I said last week, these are the kinds of jobs that unauthorized migrants are able to procure with relatively low risk of being reported. And these are not the kinds of jobs that the Republicans of America are lining up to be hired for anyway. In 2021, Latinx immigrants made up 8.2% of the U.S. workforce. They also accounted for 14% of work-related deaths that same year. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor, quote, "Fatal injuries to this group were more prevalent in the field of construction, with falls, slips, and trips being the most frequent, even leading to death." This is devastating. And if I hear one person say, well, they made the choice to come to this country, they chose to take such a dangerous job, I may actually elbow them in the fucking nose. One poll from 2023 with a sample size of 3,358 immigrant adults showed that most immigrants, regardless of where they come from or how long they've been in the United States, say that they came to the U.S. for more opportunities for themselves and their children. And if our government didn't want immigrants to come to this country in the first place, then why did they sell this whole American dream thing so hard to other countries? A majority of immigrants say that they came to the U.S. for a better financial situation. 78% say they came for better educational opportunities for themselves and their children. 79% came for better employment. And 75% came for safety. 65% of those polled said that their lives are now better as a result of moving to the United States. But even if that is so, immigrants face a disproportionate amount of workplace discrimination, they have more difficulties making ends meet, and they have more confusion and fears related to U.S. immigration laws and policies. This is far more likely for Black and Latinx immigrants, who are also more likely to be undocumented than white immigrants, and those who are not proficient in the English language. So, they're left with some of the most dangerous jobs. And in a culture that supposedly honors its heroes, police officers, firefighters, etc., they don't seem to be honoring the people that are doing these incredibly difficult jobs. But in a list that I found online of the most dangerous jobs, police officer is the 22nd most dangerous job, with firefighting supervisor being number 9. But get this, logging is the most dangerous job. Mining is at number 3. Roofers are number 4. Garbage collecting was at number 5. And a little further down the line are power line workers and crossing guards, and construction workers are at number 14. All of those jobs are considered to be more dangerous than being a police officer. Let that sink in. So why do we not hail our agricultural workers, our construction workers, and fuck, even our garbage collectors with more respect? Why do we see the loss of migrant workers as lesser than? Why do we see migrants themselves as less than? There is a term, and I hate it, but it's true, and it's called the less dead. And this refers to a victim from a marginalized group who are viewed to have lesser prestige or power in society. Other kinds of victims included in the less dead are sex workers, Native American and Indigenous people, Black trans women, etc. So on this show, we are not going to forget the brave souls who lost their lives earlier this week. Not all of the names have been released, but this is what I have so far. Alejandro Hernandez Fuentes and Dorlian Roniel Castillo Cabrera were the men recovered on Wednesday morning. Fuentes was from Mexico and Cabrera was originally from Guatemala. Maynard Suazo, 38, fought every day for his family to get ahead, according to his sister Norma. His brother Freddie described him as smiley and the kind of person who worked hard for the well-being of his family. Maynor was from Honduras and has been in the States for the last 17 years. When he died, he left behind an 18-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter. He was also the baby of the family and was known for his sense of humor. Miguel Luna, 49, was a construction worker from El Salvador and was a husband, a father of three, and had called Maryland his home for the last 20 years. Like I said, the names of the other victims have yet to be released, but we know that one of them was a 35-year-old man from Guatemala, and the last was from Mexico. That is all the information that I have that I thought would be important for all of you to learn. This is something that, obviously, I think all of us are going to be keeping an eye on for a long time. This is obviously a terrible tragedy, and it's going to take a lot of time to both metaphorically and physically rebuild. And my heart goes out to the family members and the loved ones who have lost someone that is so special to them. And I hope that they are given the amount of condolence and respect and grievance that is necessary and that should be given to them during this time. I would hate for them to feel like we don't care that their loved ones lost their lives. We cannot treat anyone as lesser than anyone else. No one is less human than anyone else. And that is the only topic I have for you today. Oh gosh, that's such a bummer. I need to go do something now that's going to distract me. I'm gonna go take care of the chihuahua I'm taking care of. All right, be sure to hang on until the end of this episode where you will hear a little bit of the episode where I cover Rachel Corey's story and her tragic death. But until then, if there's anything in particular that you want me to cover in a mini episode, please reach out to me. You can email me at neighborhoodfeminist@gmail.com or direct message me on Instagram at @angryneighborhoodfeminist and be sure to follow me there as well. What are you doing if you're not? And if you like the show and you think others would too, one of the best ways that you can support the show is by going to Apple Podcasts and leaving a 5-star review with a quick sentence about why you enjoy the show. Feel free to rate on Spotify as well. I really, really appreciate it. And definitely be sure to go join over on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/angryneighborhoodfeminist or click the link in the show notes. And that way you will be able to hear the rest of this episode that I'm gonna start right now. A couple of weeks ago for the mini episode, I covered the self-immolation death of Aaron Bushnell. And in doing so, I also learned of another activist from the United States named Rachel Corey, who lost her life back in 2003 when she went to Gaza with a charity that she had joined. And that was another really huge story internationally at the time. And what Rachel Corey went through and the things that she was fighting for and against in Gaza very much resonates today. So I thought I would share with you what I've learned about Rachel Corey. In March 2003, Rachel Corey, a student at the Evergreen State College in Washington and an activist, was killed while in Rafah, Gaza, where she joined other International Solidarity Movement, ISM, activists in efforts to prevent Israel's demolition of Palestinian property. Rachel was born on April 10, 1979, in Olympia, Washington. She was the youngest of three children to Craig and Cindy Corey. The Coreys kind of remind me of my family, minus the siblings, as I'm an only child. My parents were white, raised Catholic, and became middle class once my dad started making good ad money, but both of them had always leaned very liberal. And Rachel's whole family is like white, blonde hair, blue eyed, quote unquote, all American, even though I fucking hate that term. I think it is so racist. But that is, I think, what a lot of publications at the time described Rachel as. And Rachel herself described her family as, quote, average Americans, politically liberal, economically conservative, middle class. When Rachel was 10 years old, she spoke at the fifth grade conference on world hunger, saying, quote, I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us and we are ignoring them. We have to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have to understand that they dream our dreams and we dream theirs. We have to understand that they are us, we are them. My dream is to stop hunger by the year 2000. My dream is to give the poor a chance. My dream is to save the 40,000 people who die each day. My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. If we ignore hunger, that light will go out. If we all help and work together, it will grow and burn free with the potential of tomorrow. Holy shit, she was 10 years old when she wrote that. That is so unbelievably well thought out and so beautiful, so fucking smart. Oh my God. I take care of kids. I don't know if I've ever heard of a 10-year-old be quite so eloquent, although T was a thinker. Maybe T would have done something not quite so well written, but the thought behind it maybe would have been there. After graduating from Capitol High School, she went to Evergreen State College, which was in her hometown of Olympia, Washington. After a year there, she decided to take a year off and work as a volunteer for the Washington State Conservation Corps. With the group, she spent the next 3 years making weekly visits to patients in mental health facilities. When she got back to Evergreen State College, she became known as a committed peace activist, arranging events through a local group called Olympians for Peace and Solidarity. She later joined the International Solidarity Movement Organization, ISM, which protests against the policies of the Israeli army in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. As a senior in college, she proposed an independent study program in which she could travel to Gaza, join the ISM team, and initiate a sister city project between Olympia and Rafah. Before leaving the States, she also organized a pen pal program for children in Olympia and Rafah. Such a great idea. I loved pen pal programs when I was growing up. It was so much fun. I remember that we did a pen pal situation with a bunch of people in nursing homes at one point, and that was super fun. Oh, so sweet. Rachel Corrie left behind many, many diary entries and emails that she sent her loved ones. And in one such diary entry from January 2003, now entitled Leaving Olympia, Rachel wrote, "We are all born and someday we'll all die, most likely to some degree alone. What if our aloneness isn't a tragedy? What if our aloneness is what allows us to speak the truth without being afraid? What if our aloneness is what allows us to adventure, to experience the world as a dynamic presence, as a changeable, interactive thing?" Okay, everyone, I hope that you enjoyed that. Again, go to patreon.com/angryneighborhoodfeminist to listen to the rest of that episode. That is all I have for you today. With all of that being said, I encourage you to rage on. Bye.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to season one, we are thrilled to announce the launch of season two. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make season two even more memorable together.